In an election season that has grown so bitter, divisive, and personal, we're taking another look at the issues that concern voters in this state. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. The upcoming elections are widely viewed as pivotal for the direction of this state and the country. People are concerned about issues like gun control, education, or paying for their health care. On today's show, we're shedding some light on the way that some of these concerns are playing out in Florida. First, medical marijuana is back on Florida's ballot this year. Voters will decide on a constitutional amendment that would legalize it. A similar measure was narrowly defeated in 2014. Reporter Abe Abaraya explains the controversy swirling around Amendment 2.
12-year-old Christina Clark takes medical marijuana. Her mother, Annalisa Clark, uses it to treat the seizures her daughter has had since she was 3 months old. At her worst, Annalisa says,
she wasn't doing anything. She just literally laid on the couch and shook and twitched.
Annalisa says her daughter was locked in a fetal position. She couldn't hold her head up, swallow her own spit, or control her bodily functions. After trying 17 different pharmaceutical drugs, Annalisa turned to medical marijuana. Now, Christina Clark sits at a small table in the living room of her suburban Jacksonville home. She pulls toys out of a box, one by one, and plays. The drug Annalisa credits with keeping her daughter seizure-free for the last 8 weeks is a medical marijuana oil from Hungary, a small glass bottle with a rubber dropper at the top.
These are just everything she's ever been on. This is another one we've tried.
Oh, wow.
So this one you just do drops.
Annalisa keeps a note on her fridge with instructions on what to do if she's arrested. That's because full-strength medical marijuana is illegal in Florida. Amendment 2 is trying to change that, but opponents are sounding the alarm.
With Amendment 2, pot will be legally dispensed by bud tenders, not pharmacists. In pot shops, not pharmacies. No prescription needed.
They say Amendment 2 would be a de facto legalization of recreational marijuana. Among the amendment's detractors is Orange County Sheriff Jerry Demings. The issue is personal for him. His brother was addicted to heroin and cocaine and died in 1999 from an opioid overdose.
And my brother first was introduced to an illegal substance, controlled substance, back in the late 60s. Marijuana was that substance, and that ultimately, I think, created the type of desire in him to experiment with other illegal substances.
Opponents like Demings worry Amendment 2 would make medical marijuana as easy to get as it is in California. That state legalized the drug for medical use in 1996. John Calkins is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University's Hines College. He's been studying drug policy for 25 years. He says Florida's proposal is more restrictive than California's law.
The list of conditions for which somebody can get a recommendation does not have the obvious gaping loophole that the authors of the California proposition inserted, likely intentionally, because they wanted to create such a loophole.
In California, patients can get medical marijuana if they say they have pain and anxiety. Florida's Amendment 2 would require a diagnosis of one of 10 conditions, things like cancer, epilepsy, HIV/AIDS, and multiple sclerosis. But would medical marijuana actually help a patient with those conditions? Dr. Igor Grant is the director of the Center for Medical Cannabis Research at the University of California, San Diego.
It is not true that cannabis has no value whatever and there's no science.
Grant says there's research to show medical marijuana is effective in treating four conditions: nerve pain, symptoms of multiple sclerosis, nausea, and low appetite.
It is also not true that it is a panacea and will cure everything. So it's, it's in between.
Backers and opponents have spent a total of more than $5 million to sway voters on Amendment 2. If it passes, the debate will likely shift to implementation. The amendment leaves a lot of those details up to the Florida Department of Health. I'm Abe Abaraya in Orlando.
last summer, a terrorist proclaimed allegiance to ISIS before carrying out a deadly shooting attack on an Orlando gay nightclub. That sparked some people to demand stricter gun control in Florida. But state lawmakers are divided over how to respond to the tragedy. As Renata Sago reports, both sides are preparing for a marathon legislative fight.
50 people, including the gunman, died in Orlando's Pulse nightclub, and Florida gun control advocates hoped lawmakers would be compelled to propose stricter gun laws. They urged a special legislative session, but Governor Rick Scott rejected the idea. At a press conference 3 weeks after the shooting, he explained why.
The Second Amendment's been around for over 200 years. The Second Amendment didn't kill anybody. Evil does.
Scott does back the idea of banning gun sales to suspected terrorists. The so-called no-fly, no-buy concept has support from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. But Florida gun control advocates think it's not enough.
We're horrified by the type of weapon that was used at Pulse.
Patricia Brigham heads the Florida Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence. The League of Women Voters created the group in response to the Pulse shooting. Brigham has spent the past 3 years battling what she calls bad gun bills as part of the league's efforts.
Campus carry, open carry, stand your ground expansion. We were constantly sort of on the defensive. We thought it's time to go after some proactive, smart gun legislation.
The coalition has proposed two changes, universal background checks and a ban on semi-automatic weapons. More than 90 groups, gun safety, faith-based, healthcare, have signed on.
It's a reflection of how many in our state want something done about it.
Democratic State House candidate Beth Tura is one of them. Inside her living room, the political newcomer from Orlando is looking at her packed campaign calendar.
So what have we got for next week? What are we doing?
Tura is openly gay, and when she started her campaign, LGBT rights were at the center of her platform. She added gun control as a focus after the Pulse shooting.
Pulse is 2 miles from my house. Anybody who went to any of the memorials, I mean, that was on the topic on everybody's lips. You know, why did this happen? You know, what can we do to prevent this from happening again?
John Guttmacher has an answer, and it's not more gun control.
Primary problem number one is mental health, which we are not addressing. Okay, and the second problem are terrorists.
In the past 35 years, Guttmacher's been an NRA-certified firearms instructor, a prosecutor, and a police legal advisor. He's also an unabashed pro-gun guy who's written a 350-page book on Florida gun law.
There are the pages. Anybody who doesn't own a gun has no idea of what the laws are. Anybody who owns a gun probably doesn't have a very good idea of what the laws are either because they're too complicated and there are too many of them.
And he believes they don't address the underlying causes of gun violence. Nicole Doucette agrees. She was at a vigil the night of the Pulse shooting, and one of her friends who was in the club was still unaccounted for.
Things like this, gun control wouldn't prevent it. It's the people. It's just the people in general and the hate that they have in their hearts, because he could have went in there with several other weapons of choice, minus guns, and it could have been just as bad.
She also thinks stricter gun control would just feed the black market. But the Florida Coalition to Prevent Gun Violence argues restricting access to guns could help prevent future mass shootings. Patricia Brigham says the group is working with national organizations to draft legislation.
We know it's going to be tough, that it's not going to be a 5K, it's going to be a marathon.
Her group is also trying to educate voters on the candidates' positions on the issue because the legislature could debate gun control as early as next year. I'm Renata Sago in Orlando.
LGBT issues also came to the forefront after the Pulse nightclub massacre. In parts of Florida, it's legal to fire people based on their sexual orientation. A same-sex couple can get married on the weekend and fired from work on Monday. A bipartisan coalition of lawmakers, businesses, and LGBT advocates is trying to expand the state's anti-discrimination law to include LGBT protections. Crystal Chavez has more. boxes and stacks of Wedding RSVP's crowd, Kelly Bardiere and Jackie Pfeiffer's suburban Orlando dining room. The couple's getting ready to tie the knot in Cocoa Beach. Their dogs, Sophie and Sadie, jump about.
A wedding shower on Sunday and a wedding on October 28th, so it's crazy.
Last year, the pair worked at a taxpayer-funded pre-K program run by a Loma United Methodist Church in Winter Park. After rumors swirled about their relationship, Bardier says they got called into the director's office.
She said, you guys can just sweep it under the rug, pretend it never happened. You know, if you can come back after spring break straight, then you have your job.
The women threatened to sue the pre-K under Orange County's human rights ordinance. It prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The case was settled out of court. The couple got more than $28,000 and letters of recommendation for future employment. 37 other local governments in Florida have non-discrimination ordinances like Orange County's. The proposed Competitive Workforce Act would extend the protections to the whole state. It would ban discrimination based on sexual orientation in the workplace, housing, and public accommodations.
Post-Pulse, I think it's very, very important that Florida leaders send a message that our state is a place that doesn't tolerate discrimination of any form, including discrimination against gay and transgender people.
That's Carlos Guillermo Smith. He's running for an Orlando area state house seat with no Republican challenger. He also works for gay rights group Equality Florida. Smith says LGBT advocates have met with the governor's staff several times since the Pulse nightclub shooting in June. And some Republican lawmakers have been shifting their tone about the LGBT community. Here's U.S. Senator Marco Rubio speaking at a gathering of evangelical leaders in Orlando in August.
And if any of us, myself included, in any way, have ever made anyone feel that Christianity wants nothing to do with them, then I believe deeply that we have failed to represent our Lord Jesus Christ.
Still, Orlando civil rights attorney Mary Meeks isn't holding her breath when it comes to the state anti-discrimination bill.
It's the leadership that kills it year after year after year. And they won't even put it up to a vote. They won't even let it out of committee.
The five state senators who voted against the bill in the last legislative session said they weren't available to be interviewed for this story. In the past, some lawmakers have said the law could prompt new rules about transgender bathroom use leading to potential safety problems. On the business side, the Florida Chamber of Commerce is not taking a position, but says some businesses, particularly smaller ones, may not want another government mandate or another avenue for lawsuits in state court. Meanwhile, Jackie Pfeiffer is still trying to find the right job. She feels compelled now to share her sexual orientation with potential employers.
They don't ask about it, but I like feel like I have to disclose it just so the situation doesn't happen again because it was so awful.
Pfeiffer wants to work someplace where she can be herself. And some Florida businesses do have their own non-discrimination policies. But the fate of the Florida Competitive Workforce Act will be up to next year's legislative leaders. I'm Crystal Chavez in Orlando.
We're talking about the political issues that concern Florida voters, including health care. Coming up...
He doesn't have health insurance because he can't afford the monthly premiums.
I bring home $300 a week. Between my wife and I, that's enough to pay bare minimum. We pay the bills, and it's just enough to get by.
I'm Robin Sussingham. This is Florida Matters. Thanks for joining us. I'm Robin Sussingham, and this is Florida Matters. We're talking about some of the major issues that concern the state's voters this election season. Healthcare is a big issue in Florida. One reason? About 2.8 million of the state's residents are uninsured. There are those that argue that part of the answer is for the state to expand Medicaid as proposed under Obamacare. Republicans say that would be too expensive. And Medicaid expansion is not getting much attention from this year's legislative candidates. WUSS Daylena Miller tries to find out why.
It's a busy Monday morning at the St. Petersburg Free Clinic. The agency provides free health care for those who can't afford it. Philip Bertel is here for a checkup. The 60-year-old needs refills for his diabetes and cholesterol medications. Dr. Trudy Grossman pulls out the stethoscope.
Let's listen to your lungs in the back, okay? Big breath in and out.
Bertel works full-time in a restaurant at a hotel on St. Pete Beach. He doesn't have health insurance because he can't afford the monthly premiums.
I bring home $300 a week. Between my wife and I, that's enough to pay bare minimum. We pay the bills, and it's just enough to get by.
Ertel makes too much money to qualify for Medicaid. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, offered to pay for states to expand the program to cover more people like Ertel. The states would eventually have to pick up 10% of the cost. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation survey, more than 500,000 Floridians like Ertel would be covered under that plan. But most states with Republican governors, like Florida, refused Medicaid expansion because of concerns about cost. Political analyst Wendy March says incoming Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran has also vowed to block it.
He made a speech on the House floor, ardently drawing a line in the sand and saying the House absolutely will not consider Medicaid expansion. We won't dance, was the phrase he repeated over and over again during this speech.
Corcoran and other vocal opponents of Medicaid expansion turned down or did not respond to requests to comment for this story. In the past, they've raised concerns that the federal government will eventually stop paying for the expanded program, leaving the state burdened with the full cost. According to a recent survey by research firm Nielsen, 68% of Floridians favor expansion, and healthcare advocacy groups like Florida Chain continue to push for it. Democrat Mark Pafford leads that group. He's also Florida's outgoing House Minority Leader. He's stepping down because of term limits. He believes expansion will eventually happen.
You know, the legislature is like this living organism, and you can't allow it to shut down. And part of that means you have to keep issues like a massive effort to provide health care to every Floridian. You know, those that aren't getting it will have it. You have to keep that alive.
All of the seats in the Florida legislature are up for re-election on November 8th. But analysts like March don't think Democrats will make enough gains to push Medicaid expansion through. And candidates are not making it a political issue either.
You will definitely hear Democrats talking about it, but that's more of a rhetorical flourish than setting the groundwork for any concrete action. I think they know that it's not going to pass.
Meanwhile, charities like the St. Pete Free Clinic continue to help where they can. Beth Houghton, the clinic's executive director, says they'd lose a lot of patients if Medicaid expansion happens, but
we would love to put ourselves out of business.
Political watchers think the next time that could be a real possibility is after 2018, if a Democrat should win the governor's mansion. I'm Daylena Miller in Tampa.
Education is often a key campaign issue in Florida, but this year there's a new wrinkle, the so-called testing opt-out movement. Each spring, third graders in the state's public schools must take a standardized reading test. Students who fail can be held back. But a group of parents is challenging the state's retention policy in court, and they want lawmakers to back them up. WUSF's Kathy Carter explains.
The day before school let out, in May, 9-year-old Haley Everett brought home a certificate for making the honor roll at Chokochaty Elementary School in Hernando County. The next day, her grandmother and guardian, Pam Everett, got a call from the school's principal telling her Haley would not be promoted to to fourth grade.
My jaw hit the floor. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Here's this student that is two grades above her reading level, and then to tell me they're going to retain it because no score.
Haley had no score on the Florida Standards Assessment because her grandmother told her not to take it. But she did break the seal on the exam and signed her name to it. Everett says that means her granddaughter participated in the test as the state requires. Everett and 13 other plaintiffs from 7 counties filed a lawsuit saying their kids were wrongly held back. State law says schools may consider things besides the FSA, like teacher assessments and good report cards, but some districts interpret the law to mean no test score, no promotion. In August, a Leon County judge sided with the plaintiffs, but several school districts appealed, leaving opt-out students in limbo and angering parents like Brandy Paternoster in Broward County.
Let me be clear. I will not go quietly into the night. I stand here for our teachers. I stand here for my children, for all the children. They are more than a test score.
The mother's plea to the Broward County School Board was effective. In late September, Broward dropped its appeal. Paternoster's 9-year-old twins are now fourth graders. Sarasota County Schools also dropped out of the case. So the number of school districts fighting the ruling is down to 5. Criticism over mandated testing has grown for years, but proponents say the assessments catch students who fall behind in time to help them. Shan Goff is the Florida Policy Director for the Foundation for Excellence in Education.
Students who are not reading proficiently in third grade are 4 times more likely not to graduate high school.
Last year, a dozen civil rights groups, including the NAACP and the Urban League, issued a statement criticizing the opt-out movement. They argued testing identifies important inequalities in education for minority and low-income students and for children with disabilities. But the anti-testing chorus is getting louder, and opponents want to make sure lawmakers are listening. The Opt-Out Florida Network issued a voter guide detailing candidates' positions on testing. The group is actively campaigning for politicians sympathetic to their cause. Back in Hernando County at a recent community event, opt-out grandparent Pam Everett gathered signatures on a petition to oust the county's school superintendent.
Our goal is to take it back to the classroom. We want the teachers to teach the class. We want it teacher-generated. You are a taxpayer. Would you like to help us?
On the morning after the judge ruled in her favor, Everett's granddaughter got up early, excited to go back to school. But when they got there, the principal told them Haley would have to go back to third grade. She's now being homeschooled, but Everett says that's not by choice.
This is her school. This is where her friend's at. If I could get her back in, she would go.
But she says she would continue to fight a system that opt-out families say has forced educators to teach to the test.
You know, just because I got her spot back would not mean that I would go away. The system still is broken. It needs to be fixed. This testing needs to go the wayside.
Even if Haley gets promoted, her grandmother says she will always opt out of the FSA. But as a fourth grader, the stakes wouldn't be as high. Mandatory retention wouldn't be an issue again until Haley is in 10th grade. As for the lawsuit, plaintiffs in Hernando, Orange, Osceola, Pasco, and Seminole counties are awaiting a ruling on the appeal. I'm Kathy Carter in Tampa.
Solar energy will be on Florida's ballot again in November. Voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment on the issue recently, but the next proposal is more controversial. Wilson Sayer unpacks what exactly Amendment 1 would do.
40 solar panels line the top of David Rifkind's home in South Miami. His roof is angled perfectly to capture the most direct sun. But it helps with other things, too.
In our case, it's mostly peacock poop that we have to wash off with the rainwater.
To understand Amendment 1, we have to go over a few basics of how solar panels like Rifkind's work. First, most people who have solar panels still need to get some of their power from utilities. They're still connected to the grid. The second thing you have to understand is what's called net metering. It's called that because there is a special kind of electrical meter involved. Rifkind's is attached to his garage, keeping track of what his solar panels produce and what he gets from Florida Power and Light.
There's the Dell number and then there's the receive number. So deliver is actually what they send to us and receive is what they get back from us.
During the day, the solar panels often produce so much electricity his family can't use it all. So it gets pushed onto the grid. He gets credited for that on his meter. His neighbor might use some of the electricity or someone a few houses down. But then the clouds roll in, or the sun goes down, and the solar panels don't produce electricity. To keep the AC and fridge on, his house pulls electricity from the grid. And you can watch the meter go back and forth, pulling and pushing electricity.
Oh, and now it just shifted. So now we're just receiving a little bit more from them. You know why? Because it just got shady all of a sudden. That's why.
And this back and forth has financial implications.
The amount of electricity we do not have to purchase from the utility every year is equal to about 8% of the installed price of the solar panels.
So his investments in the panels will pay for itself in about 12 years. That's assuming the value of the solar power he contributes to the grid and the cost to be connected to the grid stay the same. Opponents of Amendment 1 are afraid those things could change if it passes. So what Amendment 1 actually says is that consumers who don't have solar panels won't be forced to subsidize the cost of the grid for those who do. To Screven Watson, that's just a logical protection. He's with Consumers for Smart Solar, which is behind the amendment. He says people who don't use solar shouldn't have to pay more for the upkeep of the grid.
The cost to do the maintenance, to do the repairs in storms, is all sort of, if you will, baked into our electric bill. But if all of a sudden everybody had solar didn't have to pay, you know, people who don't choose solar's rates are going to go up.
He says he wants more solar in the state, but not on the backs of people who can't afford it. But on the other side, people like Stephen Smith with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy say this amendment is just the utility companies pushing back on consumers who are reducing their dependency on utilities.
If you go in your home and you put in a more efficient refrigerator, a new LED light bulb, you're going to use less power. Now, does the utility have a right to say that you've got to continue to pay them even though you're not using as much? I don't think so.
The fact is, the amendment isn't specific about how people who use solar would have to help pay for the upkeep of the grid. Smith is worried there could be a fee for people like Rifkind to connect to the grid, or that the rate he gets paid to contribute energy might go down. And that could make solar less attractive to individuals and leave it in the hands of utility-built solar farms. Utilities are the main financial backers of the amendment. Supporter Screven Watson says that concern is unfounded.
I can't imagine a scenario where a cost like this would ever be prohibitive. I really don't.
To make the amendment stick, 60% of voters will need to cast their ballots in support of it in November. I'm Wilson Sayre in Miami.
That's it for today's show. What's your take on these hot-button issues? We're always glad to hear your comments. You can tweet us at Florida Matters, find us on the WUSF Facebook page, email us at floridamatters@wusf.org. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.